From NPR News in Washington, this is special live coverage of President Barack Obama's address to a joint session of Congress on the subject of health care. I'm Melissa Block. At the U.S. Capitol in a few moments, the president will enter a packed House chamber to address lawmakers and to speak to all Americans to try to sell his plan to overhaul the nation's health care system. It is a steep challenge with sharp disagreement among Republicans and Democrats about how exactly to do that. And public support for the big changes in health care has eroded. With us now in the studio as we wait for the president to enter the chamber are NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hey, Mara.
Hello, Melissa.
And Julie Rovner is also here. She covers health policy. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Melissa.
And Mara, let's start with you. The president tonight obviously trying to seize the message on health care, some feeling that it's been slipping away from him over the last several weeks. What would it take to get his health care efforts back on track?
Well, actually, I hate to argue the premise of your question, but the White House doesn't believe they're off track.
Right.
They actually are moving forward. They certainly took on a lot of water over August, but the committee process is moving forward. The Senate Finance Committee, the last committee we've been waiting for, is actually going to markup next week. But I do think what the president has to do tonight is give a speech that's less about inspiring rhetoric and more about substance. And I think he has to clear up a lot of confusion. That is what August left us with. People just don't understand what his plan means for them. He's going to tell people with insurance how the plan that he will eventually sign is going to make their insurance more affordable and more stable and more secure. He's going to tell people without insurance how they can get affordable coverage. He's going to tell taxpayers how much this is going to cost. And he's also going to talk specifically about how this is going to work. What mechanisms is he going to put in place to finance it? And I also think he will address the most contentious issue to date, which is the public option. I don't think he's going to come down four square on either side of the debate that's been dividing his own party. But I think we will get a little bit more from him on that.
And the First Lady has just entered the chamber, making her way through the gallery. There will be a number of guests, Julie Rovner, in that gallery with her, a number of people who've had very hard time with their own health issues, and the president presumably will be telling some of their stories tonight as well.
Yes, indeed, actually. And next to the First Lady, we see Vicky Reggie Kennedy,
yes.
Indeed, who I'm sure the president will address.
The widow of the late Senator.
The widow
Ted
of the
Kennedy,
late Senator Ted Kennedy, indeed, who I think is the first time yesterday, of course, was the first day that Congress reconvened without Senator Kennedy there in some 47 years. So it's really been quite
here comes the cabinet.
Yes. I think we're not going to get to the president for a little while.
A little bit. We have a little bit more time here, and of course we'll go to him as he makes his way into the chamber. Julie, Mara was talking about the public option. This has been such a volatile issue of how strongly the president could or should come out in favor of a public option, whether he would make this sort of the be-all and end-all of his plan. Would he support it if that were not included? Where do you think the White House is headed on that?
Well, you know, the president's got to walk a tightrope on this. What you have right now is a House where you've got a lot of members who don't want to pass a bill unless
I'm going to pause for just a second. I'm sorry, Julie. Hillary Clinton walking into the chamber right now, now Secretary of State, but of course we'll remember that it was, about 15 years ago that she was trying health care as the First Lady under President Bill Clinton. That effort, of course, failed. Now coming in as Secretary of State.
Yeah,
continue,
but,
Julie.
You know, a lot of us reporters who covered that speech 16 years ago are having deja vu moments. I bet Hillary Clinton's having a real deja vu
when
moment
when Bill
here
Clinton
tonight.
Came
yeah.
to a joint session of Congress, in September of 1993.
But when you know, you get back to that this public plan, you've got an issue. You've got the House, who for a lot of these liberal Democrats really want this public plan. It's an article of faith for them. They don't want to vote for a bill that doesn't have it. And you've got the Senate. Max Baucus, the Senate Finance Committee Chair, came out today and said rather emphatically that he has come to the conclusion that a public plan cannot pass the Senate. So really where you have President Obama, and he's been in this place pretty much all along, despite what's been said, is that he wants a public plan. It's his preference, but that it is not a make or break issue for him. And I don't imagine that he's going to say anything terribly different here tonight.
Mara, lots of questions here about bipartisanship and how far the president should go in trying to win over Republican votes in the Senate. On the House side, pretty much all Republicans have lined up solidly against any effort for a health care overhaul that's been proposed. On the Senate side, how hard do you think they will fight to win over some moderate Republicans for this?
Well, first of all, there's a very, very small pool of Republicans that they even consider available to them. I think for the purposes of this speech, reaching out to Republicans is very important. No matter what happens in this, the president wants to make sure that the public believes that he did everything he could to get Republicans on board, and it's the Republicans who decided not to. So I do think what you will hear in this speech is some very specific kind of olive branches to Republicans. He's going to talk about a lot of the Republican ideas that are in his plan, ideas that were originated by Republicans, whether they were out in the states or by his former rival for the presidency, John McCain. So I do think you're going to hear bipartisanship in the speech. But the bottom line is the White House has now decided what their goal is to get 60 votes in the Senate, which means if you can get all the Democrats, you need very, very few Republicans, maybe only one.
That is an if, though, because, of course, there are moderate Democrats
right.
who have caused some trouble.
Yeah, although in talking to White House officials, you know, I've been asking them questions, is there any difference substantively between a bill that would get Olympia Snow and maybe Susan Collins and the bill who would get Evan Bayh and Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu? No,
moderate
there's
Democrats.
Really no difference. If
so
you
long
find
as they
the
get
center,
to 60.
If you find the center, all of those people will be there. You don't have to do something special just to get Olympia Snow. It's the same thing you do to get Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu and Evan Bayh.
Let's talk a little bit about the tone still here, Mara. In terms of what expectations are for the president, there are critics who have said he has been too low-key. He hasn't had the same fire that people saw during the campaign. It's coming certainly from the progressive wing who feel like maybe he's sold them out a bit. In excerpts from the speech tonight, you do get a flavor of that, of him saying, look, the time for bickering is over. The time for games has passed. I think he's going to say something like that. What else do you think? I mean, what do you expect
I think
the shape of this to be?
I think this, there is no venue where the president has a grander opportunity to communicate than before a joint session of Congress. So I think just the speech itself is going to dispel a lot of that griping on the left that he hasn't done enough, been forceful enough. I think that, you know, you could argue that the president should have done something like this at the end of July. But the fact is, he's been a victim of the legislative strategy that he chose. He decided that Congress should write the bill, and he would remain above the fray, sticking to these broad principles. And in the process, a lot of his principles have been muddied. I mean, the committee bills that started emerging didn't meet his principles in every aspect. They didn't control costs. They weren't deficit neutral, for instance. But I do think you're going to hear a feisty president. He's not going to be a left-wing president. He's still going to be the consensus seeker that he ran on. The trick for the president is he's always been a consensus seeker, and he styled himself as someone who wants to be above the partisan fray. Sometimes there is no consensus,
yep,
and you have to make a hard choice, and this is the time for him to do that.
Julie Ravner, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things a president really needs to do tonight is make this his bill. Everybody all summer keeps talking about the Obama plan. There is no Obama plan. His decision was to let Congress do this. He gave them less than a page of principles. And so right now everybody talks about the president's plan. There are four different committee plans and one to come still from the Finance Committee. Tonight is the night where the president gets to stand before the Congress and the nation and say, this is what I want for this bill to say, and this is where there becomes an Obama plan, really, for the first time. That's what he needs to do tonight.
Yes, except for there is an Obama plan, and it's what anybody thinks of any plan coming out of Congress. The thing he can do now is he can have the real Obama plan the way that he wants it, not just to be kind of a passive tool of some committee in the House.
Yeah. We should explain here that the president is running late. This speech was supposed to have begun by now. The president has not yet entered the chamber of the House, much less made his way through the hall to take the rostrum and begin his speech. So we will go to the president when he arrives, but as we say, he is running late. Julie, a couple more things to think about here. In terms of the interest groups who have at least nominally allied themselves behind the idea of reform, we saw them coming through the White House, Big Pharma, the Hospitals Association, the AARP. Are they still sort of in line behind the basic contours of what we think the president is proposing here?
Well, they're nervous. They're still there. Many of them are still running ads that say, you know, we need to fix the healthcare system. At this point, you know, the difference between now and 16 years ago is that things have gotten worse. the health care costs are still running, you know, way ahead of inflation. There was a study that just came out today that, that talked about, you know, how much worse it would be. I think it's, you know, it will be that over the next, I think it's a couple of dozen years, that, that health care is going to consume 139% of the nation's GDP. I mean, it's just the numbers are so staggering, you really cannot get your arms mm-hmm. around them. So, I mean, everybody agrees that something has to be done. Nobody likes what it is. It's going to be some bitter pills for, you know, for everyone to swallow.
So to speak.
Yeah, so to speak. But everybody agrees that, you know, there's that people are going to have to just, you know, come up and give up something. Mm-hmm. And I think the goal here is to not give up everything. And people have come to the table and given up some stuff. And really, I mean, really the opposition to this, the strong opposition to this, is coming from the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. It's really not, that's the other big difference between now and 16 years
not
ago.
Not from the interest groups.
It's not coming primarily from the interest groups. There are some interest groups.
They certainly spend a lot of money lobbying on this.
The insurance industry is not real happy. They hate the idea of a public plan. They don't think they can compete. But pretty much they have stayed off the side, you know, on the sidelines. You've got, indeed, the pharmaceutical industry, you've got the hospital industry, you've got the doctors who are, you know, still trying to push this forward. So it's a very different atmosphere than it was the last time around.
Well, let's talk a bit about what the polling numbers are showing. Mara, I don't know if you had a chance to look at the AP poll that was out today. It showed a pretty steep erosion in support for the president on this issue, as well as others. What do you make of what's happening with the public mood on health care? Is it simply a matter of the message not being conveyed, or is there some real visceral problem out there with people?
Well, I think it's both. I think the message hasn't been conveyed, but the other problem is that this is...
of the United States.
And Barack Obama is now entering the House chamber, announced there by the House Sergeant at Arms. And we'll wait for him to come into the chamber, make his way through the crowd, shaking hands as he comes for this speech, which is now running about 5 minutes late. It'll be later still by the time he gets to the front. And obviously you hear the cheers there as the president comes to talk to Congress. Mara,
saying that it's both. I mean, on the one hand, he hasn't communicated what he's wanted. On the other hand, he has. This is going to be a big government intrusion into 16% of the economy. Now, that doesn't mean it's all the things that the opponents say it is. But I think that the other thing that's happened is that the auto bailout happened.
Mm-hmm.
The bank bailout happened. The stimulus bill happened. A lot of things happened. The House of Representatives passed cap and trade, which was a painful, painful vote for many moderates, and many people considered that a tax hike in disguise. So health care comes after an unprecedented intrusion, you could say, or participation of the government in the marketplace. Now, the White House says they did it because there was an economic crisis. On the other hand, now health care seems to some people like just one step too far. So I think all that contributed to the polls softening for him. But the interesting thing is that in terms of the votes, pre-August, post-August, I don't think any member of Congress who was for the public option has changed his mind over the recess, and people who are against it are still against it. So that's been remarkably stable.
And Julie, if you look at the polling numbers, there are all sorts of what seem to be internal contradictions there, because even if they may not support what they think is the health care reform or overhaul proposal that's out there, they think something is wrong with the system. They may like their own care, but they want things to change, it seems.
Well, there have always been internal contradictions with this issue. I mean, it's like Congress. People hate Congress, but they love their congressman. You know, people hate the health care system, but they love their doctor. Mm-hmm. So you're always going to see that with issues like this. I think right now the battle is for these independents. And I think, you know, what we've seen really over August is, you know, is trying to sow the seeds of doubt. And, you know, we've seen this over and over in these healthcare debates, and I know that the president's going to talk about this tonight, about, you know, some of this misinformation and, you know, are people on the edge. And that's where, you know, it's the fight for the moderates in Congress and the fight for the independents in the public. And, you know, will this make people better off or worse off? And I think that's really what the argument is here. You're not going to get the people on the right who are worried about a government takeover of healthcare. You're not going to lose the people on the left who really, truly believe in this. It's really the fight for everybody in the middle, the lawmakers and the public.
And the president is getting closer. In fact, he has reached the rostrum. He will begin speaking in a moment. Standing behind him, of course, the Vice President Joe Biden, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, and the president is about to begin his speech on a health care overhaul. Let's take a listen.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honor to present to you the President of the United States.
Thank you. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi there introducing the President.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Please.
And the President does have a standing ovation from both sides of the aisle as he begins his speech.
Please. Be seated. Madam Speaker, Vice President Biden, members of Congress, and the American people. When I spoke here last winter, this nation was facing the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. We were losing an average of 700,000 jobs per month. Credit was frozen, and our financial system was on the verge of collapse. Now, as any American who is still looking for work or a way to pay their bills will tell you, we are by no means out of the woods. A full and vibrant recovery is still many months away. And I will not let up until those Americans who seek jobs can find them. Until those businesses that seek capital and credit can thrive, until all responsible homeowners can stay in their homes. That is our ultimate goal. But thanks to the bold and decisive action we've taken since January, I can stand here with confidence and say that we have pulled this economy back from the brink. I want to thank the members of this body for your efforts and your support in these last several months, and especially those who've taken the difficult votes that have put us on the path to recovery. I also want to thank the American people for their patience and resolve during this trying time for our nation. But we did not come here just to clean up crises. We came here to build a future. So tonight, I return to speak to all of you about an issue that is central to that future, and that is the issue of health care. I am not the first president to take up this cause, but I am determined to be the last. It has now been nearly a century since Theodore Roosevelt first called for health care reform. And ever since, nearly every president and Congress, whether Democrat or Republican, has attempted to meet this challenge in some way. A bill for comprehensive health reform was first introduced by John Dingell Sr. in 1943. 65 years later, his son continues to introduce that same bill at the beginning of each session.
And the Democrats cheering for one of their own, John Dingell, longtime congressman from Michigan. Actually, looks like members of both sides of the aisle are now standing to applaud Congressman Dingell.
Our collective failure to meet this challenge, year after year, decade after decade, has led us to the breaking point. Everyone understands the extraordinary hardships that are placed on the uninsured, who live every day just one accident or illness away from bankruptcy. These are not primarily people on welfare. These are middle-class Americans. Some can't get insurance on the job. Others are self-employed and can't afford it, since buying insurance on your own costs you three times as much as the coverage you get from your employer. Many other Americans who are willing and able to pay are still denied insurance due to previous illnesses or conditions that insurance companies decide are too risky or too expensive to cover. We are the only democracy, the only advanced democracy on earth, the only wealthy nation that allows such hardship for millions of its people. There are now more than 30 million American citizens who cannot get coverage. In just a two-year period, one in every three Americans goes without health care coverage at some point. And every day, 14,000 Americans lose their coverage. In other words, it can happen to anyone. But the problem that plagues the healthcare system is not just a problem for the uninsured. Those who do have insurance have never had less security and stability than they do today. More and more Americans worry that if you move, lose your job, or change your job, you'll lose your health insurance too. More and more Americans pay their premiums only to discover that their insurance company has dropped their coverage when they get sick, or won't pay the full cost of care. It happens every day. One man from Illinois lost his coverage in the middle of chemotherapy because his insurer found that he hadn't reported gallstones that he didn't even know about. They delayed his treatment, and he died because of it. Another woman from Texas was about to get a double mastectomy when her insurance company canceled her policy because she forgot to declare a case of acne. By the time she had her insurance reinstated, her breast cancer had more than doubled in size. That is heartbreaking, it is wrong, and no one should be treated that way in the United States of America. Then there's the problem of rising cost. We spend 1.5 times more per person on health care than any other country, but we aren't any healthier for it. This is one of the reasons that insurance premiums have gone up 3 times faster than wages. It's why so many employers, especially small businesses, are forcing their employees to pay more for insurance or are dropping their coverage entirely. It's why so many aspiring entrepreneurs cannot afford to open a business in the first place, and why American businesses that compete internationally, like our automakers, are at a huge disadvantage. And it's why those of us with health insurance are also paying a hidden and growing tax for those without it, about $1,000 per year, that pays for somebody else's emergency room and charitable care. Finally, our health care system is placing an unsustainable burden on taxpayers. When health care costs grow at the rate they have, it puts greater pressure on programs like Medicare and Medicaid. If we do nothing to slow these skyrocketing costs, we will eventually be spending more on Medicare and Medicaid than every other government program combined. Put simply, our health care problem is our deficit problem. Nothing else even comes close. Nothing else. Now, these are the facts. Nobody disputes them. We know we must reform this system. The question is how. Now, there are those on the left who believe that the only way to fix the system is through a single-payer system like Canada's, where we would severely restrict the private insurance market and have the government provide coverage for everybody. On the right, there are those who argue that we should end employer-based systems and leave individuals to buy health insurance on their own. I have to say that there are arguments to be made for both these approaches. But either one would represent a radical shift that would disrupt the health care most people currently have. Since health care represents 1/6 of our economy, I believe it makes more sense to build on what works and fix what doesn't, rather than try to build an entirely new system from scratch. And that is precisely what those of you in Congress have tried to do over the past several months. During that time, we've seen Washington at its best and at its worst. We've seen many in this chamber work tirelessly for the better part of this year to offer thoughtful ideas about how to achieve reform. Of the 5 committees asked to develop bills, 4 have completed their work, and the Senate Finance Committee announced today that it will move forward next week. That has never happened before. Our overall efforts have been supported by an unprecedented coalition of doctors and nurses, hospitals, seniors groups, and even drug companies, many of whom opposed reform in the past. And there is agreement in this chamber on about 80% of what needs to be done, putting us closer to the goal of reform than we have ever been. But what we've also seen in these last months is the same partisan spectacle that only hardens the disdain many Americans have towards their own government. Instead of honest debate, we've seen scare tactics. Some have dug into unyielding ideological camps that offer no hope of compromise. Too many have used this as an opportunity to score short-term political points, even if it robs the country of our opportunity to solve a long-term challenge. And out of this blizzard of charges and countercharges, confusion has reigned. Well, the time for bickering is over. The time for games has passed. Now is the season for action. Now is when we must bring the best ideas of both parties together and show the American people that we can still do what we were sent here to do. Now is the time to deliver on health care. Now is the time to deliver on health care. The plan I'm announcing tonight would meet 3 basic goals. It will provide more security and stability to those who have health insurance. It will provide insurance for those who don't. And it will slow the growth of health care costs for our families, our businesses, and our government. It's a plan that asks everyone to take responsibility for meeting this challenge, not just government, not just insurance companies, but everybody, including employers and individuals. And it's a plan that incorporates ideas from senators and congressmen, from Democrats and Republicans, and yes, from some of my opponents in both the primary and general election. Here are the details that every American needs to know about this plan. First, if you are among the hundreds of millions of Americans who already have health insurance through your job, or Medicare, or Medicaid, or the VA, nothing in this plan will require you or your employer to change the coverage of the doctor you have. Let me repeat this. Nothing in our plan requires you to change what you have. What this plan will do is make the insurance you have work better for you. Under this plan, it will be against the law for insurance companies to deny you coverage because of a pre-existing condition. As soon as I sign this bill, it will be against the law for insurance companies to drop your coverage when you get sick or water it down when you need it the most. They will no longer be able to place some arbitrary cap on the amount of coverage you can receive in a given year or in a lifetime. We will place a limit on how much you can be charged for out-of-pocket expenses, because in the United States of America, no one should go broke because they get sick. And insurance companies will be required to cover, with no extra charge, routine checkups and preventive care, like mammograms and colonoscopies, because there's no reason we shouldn't be catching diseases like breast cancer and colon cancer before they get worse. That makes sense. It saves money and it saves lives. Now, that's what Americans who have health insurance can expect from this plan: more security and more stability. Now, if you're one of the tens of millions of Americans who don't currently have health insurance, the second part of this plan will finally offer you quality, affordable choices. If you lose your job or you change your job, you'll be able to get coverage. If you strike out on your own and start a small business, you'll be able to get coverage. We'll do this by creating a new insurance exchange, a marketplace where individuals and small businesses will be able to shop for health insurance at competitive prices. Insurance companies will have an incentive to participate in this exchange because it lets them compete for millions of new customers. As one big group, these customers will have greater leverage to bargain with the insurance companies for better prices and quality coverage. This is how large companies and government employees get affordable insurance. It's how everyone in this Congress gets affordable insurance. And it's time to give every American the same opportunity that we give ourselves. Now, for those individuals and small businesses who still can't afford the lower-priced insurance available in the exchange, we'll provide tax credits, the size of which will be based on your need. And all insurance companies that want access to this new marketplace will have to abide by the consumer protections I already mentioned. This exchange will take effect in 4 years, which will give us time to do it right. In the meantime, for those Americans who can't get insurance today because they have pre-existing medical conditions, we will immediately offer low-cost coverage that will protect you against financial ruin if you become seriously ill. This was a good idea when Senator John McCain proposed it in the campaign. It's a good idea now, and we should all embrace it.
And Senator McCain smiling at that mention of him and his proposal for a catastrophic plan in the interim before health reform takes effect.
Now, even if we provide these affordable options, there may be those, especially the young and the healthy, who still want to take the risk and go without coverage. There may still be companies that refuse to do right by their workers by giving them coverage. The problem is, such irresponsible behavior costs all the rest of us money. If there are affordable options and people still don't sign up for health insurance, it means we pay for these people's expensive emergency room visits. If some businesses don't provide workers health care, it forces the rest of us to pick up the tab when their workers get sick and gives those businesses an unfair advantage over their competitors. And unless everybody does their part, many of the insurance reforms we seek, especially requiring insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions, just can't be achieved. And that's why, under my plan, individuals will be required to carry basic health insurance, just as most states require you to carry auto insurance. Likewise, businesses will be required to either offer their workers health care or chip in to help cover the cost of their workers. There will be a hardship waiver for those individuals who still can't afford coverage, and 95% of all small businesses, because of their size and narrow profit margin, would be exempt from these requirements. But we can't have large businesses and individuals who can't afford coverage game the system by avoiding responsibility to themselves or their employees. Improving our healthcare system only works if everybody does their part. And while there remain some significant details to be ironed out, I believe a broad consensus exists for the aspects of the plan I just outlined. Consumer protections for those with insurance, an exchange that allows individuals and small businesses to purchase affordable coverage, and a requirement that people who can afford insurance get insurance. And I have no doubt that these reforms would greatly benefit Americans from all walks of life, as well as the economy as a whole. Still, given all the misinformation that's been spread over the past few months, I realize that many Americans have grown nervous about reform. So tonight I want to address some of the key controversies that are still out there. Some of people's concerns have grown out of bogus claims spread by those whose only agenda is to kill reform at any cost. The best example is the claim made not just by radio and cable talk show hosts, but by prominent politicians, that we plan to set up panels of bureaucrats with the power to kill off senior citizens. Now, such a charge would be laughable if it weren't so cynical and irresponsible. It is a lie, plain and simple.
The toughest language we've heard from the president in his speech so far, talking about disinformation, actually calling it a lie, plain and simple, some of the rhetoric that's come from those opposed to parts of a health care overhaul.
Now, there are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally. It's not true. And one more misunderstanding I want to clear up. Under our plan, no federal dollars will be used to fund abortions, and federal conscience laws will remain in place. Now, my health care proposal has also been attacked by some who oppose reform as a government takeover of the entire health care system. Now, as proof, critics point to a provision in our plan that allows the uninsured and small businesses to choose a publicly sponsored insurance option, administered by the government, just like Medicaid or Medicare. So let me set the record straight here. My guiding principle is, and always has been, that consumers do better when there's choice and competition. That's how the market works. Unfortunately, in 34 states, 75% of the insurance market is controlled by five or fewer companies. In Alabama, almost 90% is controlled by just one company. And without competition, the price of insurance goes up and quality goes down. And it makes it easier for insurance companies to treat their customers badly by cherry-picking the healthiest individuals and trying to drop the sickest, by overcharging small businesses who have no leverage, and by jacking up rates. Insurance executives don't do this because they're bad people. They do it because it's profitable. As one former insurance executive testified before Congress, insurance companies are not only encouraged to find reasons to drop the seriously ill, they are rewarded for it. All of this is in service of meeting what this former executive called Wall Street's relentless profit expectations. Now, I have no interest in putting insurance companies out of business. They provide a legitimate service and employ a lot of our friends and neighbors. I just want to hold them accountable. And the insurance reforms that I've already mentioned would do just that. But an additional step we can take to keep insurance companies honest is by making a not-for-profit public option available in the insurance exchange. Let me be clear. Let me be clear. It would only be an option for those who don't have insurance. No one would be forced to choose it, and it would not impact those of you who already have insurance. In fact, based on Congressional Budget Office estimates, we believe that less than 5% of Americans would sign up. Despite all this, the insurance companies and their allies don't like this idea. They argue that these private companies can't fairly compete with the government. And they'd be right if taxpayers were subsidizing this public insurance option. But they won't be. I've insisted that, like any private insurance company, the public insurance option would have to be self-sufficient and rely on the premiums it collects. But by avoiding some of the overhead that gets eaten up at private companies by profits and excessive administrative costs and executive salaries, it could provide a good deal for consumers. It would also keep pressure on private insurers to keep their policies affordable and treat their customers better, the same way public colleges and universities provide additional choice and competition to students without in any way inhibiting a vibrant system of private colleges and universities. Now, it's worth noting that a strong majority of Americans still favor a public insurance option of the sort I've proposed tonight. But its impact shouldn't be exaggerated by the left or the right or the media. It is only one part of my plan and shouldn't be used as a handy excuse for the usual Washington ideological battles. To my progressive friends, I would remind you that for decades, the driving idea behind reform has been to end insurance company abuses and make coverage available for those without it. The public option is only a means to that end. And we should remain open to other ideas that accomplish our ultimate goal. And to my Republican friends, I say that rather than making wild claims about a government takeover of health care, we should work together to address any legitimate concerns you may have. For example, some have suggested that the public option go into effect only in those markets where insurance companies are not providing affordable policies. Others have proposed a co-op or another nonprofit entity to administer the plan. These are all constructive ideas worth exploring. But I will not back down on the basic principle that if Americans can't find affordable coverage, we will provide you with a choice. And I will make sure that no government bureaucrat or insurance company bureaucrat gets between you and the care that you need. Finally, let me discuss an issue that is a great concern to me, to members of this chamber, and to the public. And that's how we pay for this plan. Now, here's what you need to know. First, I will not sign a plan that adds one dime to our deficits, either now or in the future. I will not sign it if it adds one dime to the deficit, now or in the future, period. And to prove that I'm serious, there will be a provision in this plan that requires us to come forward with more spending cuts if the savings we promised don't materialize. Now, part of the reason I faced a trillion-dollar deficit when I walked in the door of the White House is because too many initiatives over the last decade were not paid for, from the Iraq War to tax breaks for the wealthy. I will not make that same mistake with health care. Second, we've estimated that most of this plan can be paid for by finding savings within the existing health care system, a system that is currently full of waste and abuse. Right now, too much of the hard-earned savings and tax dollars we spend on health care don't make us any healthier. That's not my judgment. It's the judgment of medical professionals across this country. And this is also true when it comes to Medicare and Medicaid. In fact, I want to speak directly to seniors for a moment, because Medicare is another issue that's been subjected to demagoguery and distortion during the course of this debate. More than four decades ago, this nation stood up for the principle that after a lifetime of hard work, our seniors should not be left to struggle with a pile of medical bills in their later years. That's how Medicare was born. And it remains a sacred trust that must be passed down from one generation to the next. And that is why not a dollar of the Medicare Trust Fund will be used to pay for this plan. The only thing this plan would eliminate is the hundreds of billions of dollars in waste and fraud, as well as unwarranted subsidies in Medicare that go to insurance companies, subsidies that do everything to pad their profits but don't improve the care of seniors. And we will also create an independent commission of doctors and medical experts charged with identifying more waste in the years ahead. Now, these steps will ensure that you, America's seniors, get the benefits you've been promised. They will ensure that Medicare is there for future generations. And we can use some of the savings to fill the gap in coverage that forces too many seniors to pay thousands of dollars a year out of their own pockets for prescription drugs. That's what this plan will do for you. So don't pay attention to those scary stories about how your benefits will be cut. especially since some of the same folks who are spreading these tall tales have fought against Medicare in the past, and just this year supported a budget that would essentially have turned Medicare into a privatized voucher program. That will not happen on my watch. I will protect Medicare. Now, because Medicare is such a big part of the healthcare system, making the program more efficient can help usher in changes in the way we deliver healthcare that can reduce costs for everybody. We have long known that some places, like the Intermountain Healthcare in Utah or the Geisinger Health System in rural Pennsylvania, offer high-quality care at costs below average. So the Commission can help encourage the adoption of these common sense best practices by doctors and medical professionals throughout the system. Everything from reducing hospital infection rates to encouraging better coordination between teams of doctors. Reducing the waste and inefficiency in Medicare and Medicaid will pay for most of this plan. Now, much of the rest would be paid for with revenues from the very same drug and insurance companies that stand to benefit from tens of millions of new customers. And this reform will charge insurance companies a fee for their most expensive policies, which will encourage them to provide greater value for the money, an idea which has the support of Democratic and Republican experts. And according to these same experts, this modest change could help hold down the cost of health care for all of us in the long run. Now, finally, many in this chamber, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, have long insisted that reforming our medical malpractice laws can help bring down the costs of health care. Now, there you go. Now, I don't believe malpractice reform is a silver bullet, but I've talked to enough doctors to know that defensive medicine may be contributing to unnecessary costs. So I'm proposing that we move forward on a range of ideas about how to put patient safety first and let doctors focus on practicing medicine. I know that the Bush administration considered authorizing demonstration projects in individual states to test these ideas. I think it's a good idea, and I'm directing my Secretary of Health and Human Services to move forward on this initiative today. Now, add it all up, and the plan I'm proposing will cost around $900 billion over 10 years. Less than we have spent on the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and less than the tax cuts for the wealthiest few Americans that Congress passed at the beginning of the previous administration. Most of these costs will be paid for with money already being spent, but spent badly, in the existing healthcare system. The plan will not add to our deficit. The middle class will realize greater security, not higher taxes. And if we are able to slow the growth of healthcare costs by just 0.1% each year, 0.1%, it will actually reduce the deficit by $4 trillion over the long term. Now, this is the plan I'm proposing. It's a plan that incorporates ideas from many of the people in this room tonight, Democrats and Republicans. And I will continue to seek common ground in the weeks ahead. If you come to me with a serious set of proposals, I will be there to listen. My door is always open. But know this, I will not waste time with those who have made the calculation that it's better politics to kill this plan than to improve it. I won't stand by while the special interests use the same old tactics to keep things exactly the way they are. If you misrepresent what's in this plan, we will call you out. And I will not accept the status quo as a solution. Not this time. Not now. Everyone in this room knows what will happen if we do nothing. Our deficit will grow. More families will go bankrupt. More businesses will close. More Americans will lose their coverage when they are sick and need it the most. And more will die as a result. We know these things to be true. That is why we cannot fail. Because there are too many Americans counting on us to succeed. The ones who suffer silently and the ones who share their stories with us at town halls, in emails, and in letters. I received one of those letters a few days ago. It was from our beloved friend and colleague, Ted Kennedy. He had written it back in May, shortly after he was told that his illness was terminal. He asked that it be delivered upon his death. In it, he spoke about what a happy time his last months were. Thanks to the love and support of family and friends, his wife Vicky, his amazing children, who are all here tonight. And he expressed confidence that this would be the year that healthcare reform, that great unfinished business of our society, he called it, would finally pass. He repeated the truth that healthcare is decisive for our future prosperity, but he also reminded me that it concerns more than material things. What we face, he wrote, is above all a moral issue. At stake are not just the details of policy, but fundamental principles of social justice and the character of our country. I've thought about that phrase quite a bit in recent days. The character of our country. One of the unique and wonderful things about America has always been our self-reliance, our rugged individualism, our fierce defense of freedom, and our healthy skepticism of government. And figuring out the appropriate size and role of government has always been a source of rigorous and, yes, sometimes angry debate. That's our history. For some of Ted Kennedy's critics, his brand of liberalism represented an affront to American liberty. In their minds, his passion for universal health care was nothing more than a passion for big government. But those of us who knew Teddy and worked with him here, people of both parties, know that what drove him was something more. His friend Orrin Hatch, he knows that. They worked together to provide children with health insurance. His friend John McCain knows that. They worked together on a patient's bill of rights. His friend Chuck Grassley knows that. They worked together to provide health care to children with disabilities. On issues like these, Ted Kennedy's passion was born not of some rigid ideology, but of his own experience. It was the experience of having two children stricken with cancer. He never forgot the sheer terror and helplessness that any parent feels when a child is badly sick. And he was able to imagine what it must be like for those without insurance, what it'd be like to have to say to a wife or a child or an aging parent, there is something that could make you better, but I just can't afford it. That large-heartedness, that concern and regard for the plight of others, is not a partisan feeling. It's not a Republican or a Democratic feeling. It, too, is part of the American character. our ability to stand in other people's shoes, a recognition that we are all in this together, that when fortune turns against one of us, others are there to lend a helping hand, a belief that in this country, hard work and responsibility should be rewarded by some measure of security and fair play, and an acknowledgement that sometimes government has to step in to help deliver on that promise. This has always been the history of our progress. In 1935, when over half of our seniors could not support themselves and millions had seen their savings wiped away, there were those who argued that Social Security would lead to socialism. But the men and women of Congress stood fast, and we are all the better for it. In 1965, when some argued that Medicare represented a government takeover of health care, members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, did not back down. They joined together so that all of us could enter our golden years with some basic peace of mind. You see, our predecessors understood that government could not and should not solve every problem. They understood that there are instances when the gains in security from government action are not worth the added constraints on our freedom. But they also understood that the danger of too much government is matched by the perils of too little. That without the leavening hand of wise policy, markets can crash, monopolies can stifle competition, the vulnerable can be exploited. And they knew that when any government measure, no matter how carefully crafted or beneficial, is subject to scorn, when any efforts to help people in need are attacked as un-American, when facts and reason are thrown overboard and only timidity passes for wisdom, and we can no longer even engage in a civil conversation with each other over the things that truly matter, that at that point we don't merely lose our capacity to solve big challenges. We lose something essential about ourselves. That was true then. It remains true today. I understand how difficult this healthcare debate has been. I know that many in this country are deeply skeptical that government is looking out for them. I understand that the politically safe move would be to kick the can further down the road, to defer reform one more year, or one more election, or one more term. But that is not what this moment calls for. That's not what we came here to do. We did not come to fear the future. We came here to shape it. I still believe we can act, even when it's hard. I still believe. I still believe that we can act when it's hard. I still believe we can replace acrimony with civility and gridlock with progress. I still believe we can do great things, and that here and now we will meet history's test. Because that's who we are. That is our calling. That is our character. Thank you. God bless you. And may God bless the United States of America.
You've been listening to live coverage of President Obama's address to a joint session of Congress and the nation on the subject of health care. We're awaiting the Republican response from Louisiana Congressman Charles Bustani, who also is a former heart surgeon. Mara Liasson, our national political correspondent, and Julie Rovner, our health policy correspondent, both here in the studio with me. Mara, the president beginning his speech saying, "I'm not the first president to take up this cause, but I'm determined to be the last."
That was a good line. I think
and a tough call.
Yeah, a tough call. The president tonight, I think if this speech works, it's going to be not because of the inspiring rhetoric in the speech, and there was plenty of it, but because he laid out a very specific blueprint. This was a substantive nuts and bolts speech. He was able to say things like, the plan I am announcing tonight, here are the details. And he said very specifically what people with insurance will get, the kind of protections they'll get.
If they have insurance
If they have insurance now. He explained how people without insurance could get insurance that they would be able to afford. He also explained how it would be paid for. He embraced a lot of ideas that we haven't heard him embrace before, like this idea of a soft fiscal trigger. In case it's not deficit neutral, the president would be forced to come up with ways to cut costs more. He embraced the idea of taxing, by levying a fee on insurance companies, high-cost gold-plated insurance plans. He endorsed tort reform demonstrations, not legislation, mm-hmm. just demonstration projects.
This has been a huge issue yes. for Republicans, medical
and,
malpractice.
Right, mm-hmm. and he endorsed this idea of a high-risk pool, something that John McCain had proposed during the campaign, which is while they're waiting for this exchange to be set up, which wouldn't be in place for several years, there would be a pool for people who are sick and need insurance right now and are facing financial ruin if they don't have it. So he endorsed a lot of specific ideas. He also endorsed the individual mandate, something he ran against in the Democratic primary. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as for the public option, the big point of suspense everybody's waiting right. for, he said he gave a very eloquent defense for it. But in the end, he said it's not a requirement. And he listed all the other ways that you could get to choice and competitiveness, either
without
with
it.
A trigger, yeah. with a co-op. He said they're all fine. And if you have any more ideas, you know, bring them to me.
My door's open.
Yeah. So long as we do this.
Public option, I think you said, it's a means
to
the
end. It's a
means,
not an end. Yep. That's right.
Julie Rovner, also, some of the toughest talk we heard from the president tonight was when he was taking on what he called demagoguery, distortions, disinformation out there about just what his ideas for healthcare overhaul would do.
Yes.
We don't have a lot of time before the Republican response, but why don't you talk a little bit about what he was trying to counter there?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the biggest thing is that over this August recess, we saw so many things about these, you know, death panels who are going to go out and, you know, tell Granny that mm-hmm. That she's going to be put to death. And I think the real worry here, I think, is among senior citizens. They're the ones who vote in these midterm elections.
We're going now to Congressman Charles Bustani with the Republican response.
I'm Dr. Charles Bustani, and I'm proud to serve the people of Louisiana's 7th Congressional District. I'm also a heart surgeon with more than 20 years of experience, during which I saw firsthand the need for lowering health costs. Republicans are pleased that President Obama came to the Capitol tonight. We agree much needs to be done to lower the cost of health care for all Americans. On that goal, Republicans are ready, and we've been ready, to work with the president for common sense reforms that our nation can afford. Afford is an important word. Our country's facing many challenges. The cost of health care is rising. Federal spending is soaring. We're piling huge debt on our children, and families and small businesses are struggling through a jobless recovery with more than 2.4 million private sector jobs lost since February. It's clear the American people want health care reform, but they want their elected leaders to get it right. Most Americans wanted to hear the president tell Speaker Pelosi, Majority Leader Reid, and the rest of the Congress that it's time to start over on a common-sense, bipartisan plan focused on lowering the cost of health care while improving quality. That's what I've heard over the past several months in talking to thousands of my constituents. Replacing your family's current health care with government-run health care is not the answer. In fact, it'll make health care much more expensive. That's not just my personal diagnosis as a doctor or a Republican. It's the conclusion of the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the neutral scorekeeper that determines the cost of major bills. I read the bill Democrats passed through committee in July. It creates 53 new government bureaucracies, adds hundreds of billions to our national debt, and raises taxes on job creators by $600 billion. And it cuts Medicare by $500 billion while doing virtually nothing to make the program better for our seniors. The president had a chance tonight to take the government-run health care off the table. Unfortunately, he didn't do it. We can do better with a targeted approach that tackles the biggest problems. Here are four important areas where we can agree right now. One, all individuals should have access to coverage, regardless of pre-existing conditions. Two, individuals, small businesses, and other groups should be able to join together to get health insurance at lower prices, the same way large businesses and labor unions do. Three, we can provide assistance to those who still cannot access a doctor. And four, insurers should be able to offer incentives for wellness care and prevention. That's something particularly important to me. I operated on too many people who could have avoided surgery if they made simply made healthier choices earlier in life. We do have ideas the president hasn't agreed with. We're grateful the president mentioned medical liability reform, and we hope he's serious. We need to establish tough liability reform standards, encourage speedy resolution of claims, and deter junk lawsuits that drive up the cost of care. Real reform must do this. Let's also talk about letting families and businesses buy insurance across state lines. I and many other Republicans believe that that will provide real choice and competition to lower the cost of health insurance. Unfortunately, the president disagrees. You can read more about all of these reforms at healthcare.gop.gov. These are common sense reforms that we can achieve right now without destroying jobs, exploding the deficit, rationing care, or taking away the freedoms American families cherish. This Congress can pass meaningful reform soon to reduce some of the fear and anxiety families are feeling in these very difficult times. Working together in a bipartisan way, we can truly lower the cost of health care while improving quality for the American people. I'm Dr. Charles Bustani. Thank you for listening.
That's Dr. Charles Bustani and a current member of Congress, Republican from Louisiana, giving the Republican response to President Obama. You've been listening to live special coverage of President Obama's address to Congress on health care. I'm Melissa Block. And continuing our coverage here in the studio with NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Rovner and also national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Julie, let's listen to a little bit of one of the more contentious, really the hottest contentious moment of the speech tonight when the president was trying to disprove some claims that are out there. Let's take a listen.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegal. It's not true.
And, Julie, you heard there a member of Congress, it's been reported it was a Republican from South Carolina, saying that's a lie. What's the truth here?
Boy, this has been a very hotly debated issue. I think the Republicans' problem with this is that even though the bills say that illegal immigrants are not eligible for benefits under these bills, there is a provision that says that people who are not here legally could buy policies through this new exchange. They would not be eligible for tax subsidies or credits. But it would not stop them from paying the full freight. And I think that that's one of the issues. There's also another issue with Medicaid and some of the low-income programs that exist now that the Democratic Congress actually rescinded some of the policies that the Republicans had put in that required people to prove their citizenship in such a way that it was actually preventing citizens from getting onto the programs. It wasn't really deterring people here illegally who tended, by and large, not to apply for those programs because they didn't really want to go before the government. Before government agencies, they didn't want to draw that much attention to themselves. So the Democrats wanted to repeal those policies because really all it was doing was preventing citizens from getting benefits for which they were eligible. But Republicans are claiming that that's now a backdoor way for illegals to get onto these programs. So that's what the fight's really about when it comes to illegal immigrants.
Okay, Julie, stick around. We're going to go now to a member of Congress, Representative Barbara Lee of California, a Democrat from California, also the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus. She joins us by phone from Capitol Hill. Congresswoman Lee, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
And we were just talking about that heated moment when the president was subject to some heckling from Republicans on this issue. What do you think the tone was in the chamber tonight?
Well, I tell you, many of us were very focused on what the president said. And I have to say that I thought he did a fabulous job in communicating directly to the American people. Tonight, we heard directly from him as it relates to his plan for reforming our very broken healthcare system. And I think he did a great job in dispelling the lies and the myths that are being spread by special interests and the opponents of any change to the status quo. And so the mood in the chamber, I think, was very upbeat. Of course, there are those who will not support anything that this president puts forward. But I think that he made it clear tonight that he's going to move forward he's going to come up with a very comprehensive approach, which also includes a robust public option, which many of us were listening for.
Yeah, well, let me ask you about that, because it was unclear whether he was, he did not seem to be saying tonight that that was an absolute mandate for him to sign on to this plan. Were you disappointed that he didn't go farther? You've said before that you wouldn't vote for any plan that did not have a public option.
The president said very clearly that he wasn't going to back off of an approach that included a public health insurance option. There would be a nonprofit option. There would be a plan or an option that would reduce the cost of insurance and also increase competition. He was very clear about that. Now, the details of it, of course, have to be worked through. But I was delighted to hear him restate his commitment, which he has stated before, to a public option.
He called it a means to an end, though.
Well, it is a means to an end, but it is a public option that he restated his support for. And that, for many of us who are very committed to a public option, of course, I support single payer. But short of single payer, we have to have an option that allows for competitive rates and the cost to go down. And I think that he was very clear with that and is going to support that.
Well, Congressman Lee, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
That's Barbara Lee of California. She is the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus. And we're going to go across the aisle now to Republican David Camp. He is the ranking Republican on the House Committee on Ways and Means, which is one of the committees charged with writing health care legislation. Congressman Camp, welcome to the program.
Oh, good evening.
And your take on the president's speech tonight and his program for health care overhaul.
Well, first of all, the president always gives an eloquent speech, and he certainly closed on a very personal note. I would say that he offered one small thing in the speech that I think, in terms of his lawsuit reform and his proposal to move forward at least on some pilot projects, I think it's a small step, but I think it's a very positive step in a direction to get some of the duplication in medical costs out of the system. But however, there were a number of just complete misstatements in the speech. This idea that someone wants to end employer-provided care in contrast to those who want the public option is just false. There have been many ideas offered by Republicans, more than 40 bills put into the Congress on health care alone. None of them suggest ending employer-provided health insurance. So I think some of the false choices that were presented tonight don't help move the debate forward. I think there were unnecessarily partisan comments made. I think, frankly, anytime the American people come forward and engage in an issue at the level they have on this, I think is positive, and we ought to suggest that we are listening to what they have to say as opposed to denigrating that process.
He did say his door is open. He's always open to good ideas, but don't demagogue this. Don't distort what the facts are, he's saying.
Well, his door has been open, I guess, but he hasn't had a meeting with a Republican since April. So, I appreciate his commitment to that. I think we have a lot of good ideas we've put out there. As I said, more than 40 pieces of legislation, many other ideas, and I hope that he'll be receptive to those. I do think this concern about a public option in whatever form is really a bright line for Republicans. It's not going to be something that Republicans are going to be able to support. Clearly, even in the working group in the Senate, they've not been able to coalesce around anything that includes that. So I think that we need to move ahead. And if that can be dropped, I think we can then begin bipartisan discussions on how to move ahead. I think that's going to be critical to do.
And you're saying a public option under any form that's been discussed, whether it's co-op, anything like that, you're saying off the table or we won't vote for it.
I think the public option has to be off the table. There are really some common sense reforms that we can take immediately that we need to take. There does need to be some reform in health care. Costs are too high. We need to try to insure more people. Those are goals the president restated tonight. I think all Americans agree with those. But I do believe that the public plan will not only drive private insurers out of the market, which will not be helpful. People will lose the kind of coverage they have. It will have that effect. And even analyzing the Democrats' bill, the Congressional Budget Office says 15 million Americans will lose their insurance under their proposal. So I think that's an option that really doesn't move us forward on this issue at all. And it's been unclear. We've got mixed signals from the administration. Is it a critical part of their bill, or is it something they can toss over the side? I think they need to, the more quickly they can toss that over the side, the more quickly we can move ahead on this whole issue.
Okay, Congressman Camp, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
That's Congressman Dave Camp of Michigan, ranking Republican on the House Ways and Means Committee. And we are joined now by Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont, also the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and a doctor. Governor Dean, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
We heard Congressman Camp there saying that President Obama was distorting the Republicans' ideas on health care overhaul. Do you think in the speech tonight that you heard what you wanted to hear from the president? You've been a vocal supporter of the public option. Congressman Camp saying, throw it over the side or we won't vote for it.
I thought the thing was a home run. The most important part was what he talked to the American people. He did everything he really had to do. What the American people wanted a president more than anything else is not the details of a particular complicated program. They want to know if the president's strong enough to stand up for his agenda and keep his promises. And Barack Obama showed that he did that tonight. I thought it was an extraordinary speech, especially the last 10 minutes. So, look, I obviously disagree with Representative Camp. I think the public option is essential because why would you want to put $60 billion a year into the insurance industry after they've, you know, treated people the way they have? But this isn't really a debate about the public option so much. This is a debate about whether we're going to have health care reform and whether we're going to stop playing these political games in order to get it. And we would welcome Republican input into this plan. And Republicans have good ideas, and we'd like to hear them. But unfortunately, what we've seen is back away and play games and politics and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, happy to debate the public option, but I think the most important thing was the president showed himself once again to be a very strong leader who was determined to keep his promises that he made when he got elected.
The president has been challenged not just from Republicans on the right, but also there's been some discontent among the more liberal, progressive wing of the Democratic Party, of which I would say you are a member, that he's not gone far enough, that he has not been strong enough on this issue. Do you think this was a speech maybe he should have given 6 months ago rather than this into the discussion?
It's so easy to criticize people. And that's, as David Axelrod once said to me, you know, every day is election day in Washington. I mean, there's such hype about all these kinds of things. I think the president gave a great speech. It was a very well-timed speech because there was a big to-do this summer. And he got up there and he took control. And that's just exactly what presidents are supposed to do. I thought it was terrific. I don't want to get into was this timing right or that timing right. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was a great speech. And any speech that's a speech that good is always at the right time, whenever that time may be.
And if Republicans don't come on board, that's okay, you think? A bill without bipartisanship is still a worthy bill.
Sure. I'm like the president. I want a good bill. It doesn't matter to me who votes for the bill. I just want enough votes to pass a bill to get everybody in America insured and make sure it's affordable. And most important, this is why I like the public option. I mean, I'd allow people under 65 to choose Medicare if they wanted to. Why? Because Medicare can't be taken away. They can't be deny you coverage if you're sick. It goes with you wherever you go in America. Reasonably priced. They don't charge sick people more than healthy people. Those are all things that insurance companies can't offer Americans. And my question is exactly the same as the president's question. Why can't we choose those things that Congress have? Why, if it's good enough for Congress, why isn't it good enough for the rest of the American people?
Governor Dean, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Howard Dean, former governor of Vermont, also former chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Mara Liasson and Julie Rovner, you've been listening to these conversations. Mara, what do you think? I mean, as this moves forward, what has to happen now?
Well, I think what has to happen is what always had to happen, which is that both houses of Congress have to come up with a bill and then they have to go to conference committee. I think the president is trying to heave this thing over the finish line. I mean, there have been a lot of comparisons made to the Bill Clinton health care speech before Congress 16 years ago. Mm-hmm. But Bill Clinton was giving the speech at the beginning of the process. He waited a very long time to give it. This process is well underway. And I think what President Obama has said is here's the roadmap for how you get from here to the finish line. It looks like the House of Representatives will probably pass a plan with a robust public option in it. The Senate will pass a plan that doesn't have it. And in the end, I think there will be something less than the kind of robust Medicare-style public option that liberals want, only because I don't think it can get 60 votes in the Senate. But I do think the president did something important today, and it's amazing when you think about how much time he has spent talking about health care, mm-hmm. and still people didn't get the most basic things about the plan, the kinds of things where, as he often says, we have 80% agreement, that everyone agrees on these reforms. The fact that no one will deny you coverage because of a pre-existing condition, There will be no caps on the amount of coverage you can receive in a lifetime. There'll be a limit on out-of-pocket expenses. Insurance companies will have to cover routine checkups, mammograms, colonoscopies. I mean, those are powerful, powerful reforms for people who already have insurance. I thought this speech was very clear. It was very orderly. He answered a lot of questions that people have. Now, if the goal of the speech was to clear up confusion, I think he at least succeeded in that.
Julie Revner, I want to talk to you about something that Mara just mentioned, these provisions for people who already have insurance. He's saying these would go into effect as soon as I sign this bill. We've been talking about health care overhaul, something that would kick in, what, 3-4 years down the road. He's talking about these things taking effect right away, right?
That's right. Well, some of them would, right. Not all of them. The pre-existing condition exclusions would not, and that's why they're talking about some of these high-risk pools, you know, made John McCain smile. Those would take a while, and certainly getting the people who are uninsured insured, getting these health insurance exchanges up, that would take a few years.
Right, but these provisions that Mara was just mentioning.
Yes, yes, and these are things that people, by and large, don't know about, and as Mara pointed out, these are the things that almost everybody agrees on, and these are things that a lot of people, I've been doing a lot of stories on this, people don't know they don't have. These are the things that when you have insurance, you don't realize you need until you get sick and discover that they're not there. So these are things that a lot of insurance plans don't cover. And these are the kinds of things that a lot of people need and that it's a big part of really remaking the healthcare system. Plus, there is this issue about cost. We are getting to the point as a country where something needs to be done. I think Democrats and Republicans agree that fiscally this cannot continue because the country cannot afford it.
And did the president's arguments on how the program would essentially pay for itself, did that make sense to you? Do those numbers line up?
To some extent, it's never easy to figure out how to pay for these things, and it's never easy to know what's going to really pay for this, because the Congressional Budget Office, which does the scoring, is limited in, you know, what it can score, and it can only look 10 years into the future. So it's always a little bit of a let's hold hands and jump and guess. And the Congress, as you saw, is not in a mood to hold hands and jump on anything.
We're going to go briefly now to Capitol Hill and to our congressional correspondent, Andrea Seabrook. Andrea, you've been talking to members of Congress about how they received the speech. What are they telling you?
Well, you know, Melissa, you'd think that two different speeches happened here.
Amazing, huh?
Frankly, the Republicans are using very strong language to say that this speech was a disaster. I've heard several people say that it was a very partisan speech because the president, in their words, highlighted partisan differences and used the word liars to talk about some of the misinformation that has gone around about the bills. And then Democrats, on the other hand, are coming out saying that this speech was beautiful and touching and heartfelt and going a long way to clearing some of the divides here. So it's hard to say that this speech did that when I'm hearing such different things from both sides.
Yeah, not a surprise, I suppose, that both sides would come out with a different interpretation of what they had just heard.
No, but what is interesting is I've spoken to a couple of blue dogs. These are the conservative Democrats, conservative to moderate Democrats, that are coming out of this speech saying, yes, this was a speech that was written for me. They're saying it called out both the right and the left. It talked about how the public option is not necessary, but its goals are what's important. The blue dogs are the people who seem the happiest, because the moderates seem the happiest here.
Okay. Andrea, thanks so much. Andrea Seabrook speaking with us from Capitol Hill. We've been talking about the president's address to a joint session of Congress tonight. President Obama talking about his plans for an overhaul of the nation's health care system. I also want to thank our science policy correspondent, our health policy correspondent, Julie Rovner, and our national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. In his speech, President Obama said the time for bickering is over, and he said it was time to protect millions of Americans who have insufficient health insurance or no coverage at all. He also took his Republican critics to task, at one point saying that a frequent GOP claim was a lie, plain and simple. The president was greeted with cheers by supporters, and at times he did draw boos from his critics on the Republican side. You've been listening to live special coverage of President Obama's address to Congress on health care. Our coverage continues online at npr.org and continues tomorrow on Morning Edition. I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to NPR News.